Move to Dave Gaylor, and I've had the privilege, and I say that, and it's been a real learning experience to me to work with Dave for the last 7 or 8 years, and actually during one of the last downturns here in the state of Washington for both the apple industry and our dairy industry, we set up something called the Farm Family Support Network and invited Dave out to work with us in the very beginning and help set that up. But because of his experience starting in the 80s working with farm families, Dave is the deputy director of the North Central Risk Management Education Centers, one of our close partners and collaborators in the whole risk management education area. He began his career in 84, right kind of in the midst of that 80s farm crisis. And I invite you to go at the webpage and look at his background. Contact Dave on the site if you've got questions. He's got a wealth of experience, very practical experience, because he and his high school sweetheart, Cindy, who is an exceptional photographer, are involved in their family farming operation with Dave's brother, father, and mother in northeast Nebraska. And corn, soybeans, and kids. So, Dave, without further ado, kind of set the context for us this morning. It's the floor is yours.
Okay, thank you, John. Well, let me tell you a little bit more about who I am. As John said, my wife is a photographer. One of the things that she's taken a picture of is me driving my combine right there. So I also have some background in production agriculture. But let me tell you a little bit more about what I've done in my professional career. For the last about 10-plus years, my position at the university, prior to my becoming deputy director here at the Risk Management Education Center, my position has been a transition specialist. So that means that I work with farm and ranch families that are kind of in three stages of their careers. I work with folks that are just getting started in farming. I work with people that are looking at doing estate planning, trying to pass the business down to the next generation. And the third area that I work with is folks that are having financial problems, and some of them are considering transitioning out. This is my contact information, and I'm more than happy to visit with any of you either through email or by phone or whatever, so feel free to use that if this is helpful at all. As John said, I'm in the North Central area of the United States, that kind of a flesh-colored 12-state area in the Midwest, known for, I guess you might say, plows and cows and sows. We do produce roughly half of the nation's agricultural commodities, so we do have a lot of production agriculture here. And I'm bringing from that perspective a little bit, maybe different slant than what that you might be seeing out there on the West Coast. Historically, I want to tell you a little bit more about what I have done so that you can get an idea where I'm coming from. As John mentioned earlier, I started working at the university in 1984, and we had a program called Managing for Tomorrow. Excuse me. We had a program that ran for about 4 years during the 80s, and we worked with approximately 800 farm families during that time. Since that time, we've also done legal and financial clinics. I do about 30 to 35 of these a year, and they're free financial clinics. I also do them with an attorney. And we try to set aside 1 to 2 hours per family to talk about any issues that the families might want to discuss. And, you know, we see all kinds of situations coming in there. Probably work with 300-400 operations a year. And I just have to say, all the way from the 80s through the 90s and the early part of the 2000s, that we've always had some producers that are experiencing financial problems, having financial stress. You know, our agricultural sector is not any different than folks in ordinary life. There's always problems. Health issues, financial issues, marriage issues, whatever it might be, that can contribute to having financial problems. But, you know, I don't really want to say that we're in the 1980s again, but I would also like to say that we have definitely seen an increase in folks that are having financial problems here just in about the last year. And in our area of the Midwest, we're seeing probably a heavier concentration in the dairy industry and the hog industry, the livestock feeding industry. The crop end of things, which would amount to corn and soybeans mostly in our part of the United States, we're starting to see some issues there as well, but predominantly it's been in the livestock sector, at least in the last little bit. I was asked to comment about what we saw in the 80s, and you know, some of you have gone through the 80s, and some of you maybe have not. For those of you that have not, let me just give you a little rundown. You know, we had experienced a kind of a rapid increase in farm asset values and ag asset values during the late 70s, early 80s, first year or two in the 80s in particular. And then we started to see kind of the opposite occur. We saw asset values that basically plummeted in the Midwest. Land values that probably peaked out in 81 that dropped 50 to 75% by 86, 87. At the same time that was going on, we saw really high interest rates. Ordinary interest rates 16 to 18%, default interest 22, even maybe higher in some cases. So we had a situation quite a lot different than what we see now, where the asset values had plummeted, interest rates were high, cash flows were tight, they certainly weren't good, but we didn't have as much of a cash flow issue, more of a collateralization issue. Many producers were, you know, basically insolvent if you looked at those reduced asset values. And if a lender would look at a liquidation, the result was that not only would the farmer or rancher have a virtually a zero net worth or maybe even an insolvent situation, but it translated into lender problems. And so we had several banks, a couple of farm credits that actually folded during that time. And had it not been for Chapter 12 that came in, I believe it was in 87, and FSA shared appreciation agreements, I'm not sure what would have really turned this around, but that did make quite a difference. 2009, you know, our situation's quite a lot different. We have asset values that have softened a little bit, but not a great deal. We have low interest rates, but what we have in our situation now is we literally have a world financial crisis that we've possibly bottomed out on and are turning around. And you couple with that financial crisis, you couple with that a volatility in cost of inputs and a volatility in the prices or value of production sold, and there's been a lot of producers that have really been caught in a squeeze. And in our part of the United States, it's probably caught more livestock producers than anything. So what's resulted is a cash flow that is literally terrible. We have many situations, hog producers, dairy producers, that are maybe not even covering cost of feed, let alone covering a lot of those other kinds of variable costs and some of the fixed costs. So we have a really serious situation right now. A lot of producers still have some equity, but they're really looking at a tough decision. Another thing that's a little different now than what we had in the 80s is we have a lot of folks that are coming up with a lot of credit card debt. I think our record for credit card debt is just under $250,000 for one farming operation, about a little over 30 credit cards to do that. So it's another variable that hasn't really been involved, that wasn't involved so much in the 80s. And I'll just make one little comment there. We've run across quite a few what I would call credit counseling scams, and there's been a lot of that kind of thing starting to pop up, but I'm not going to spend a lot of time on that. So what we're facing now is farmers are looking at a decision, ranchers, dairymen are looking at a decision, in many cases, do we try to preserve this equity? Just for an example, I worked with a dairy last week. They had about $500,000 worth of equity, but they were losing $1,500 a day on their cash flow. And so their decision is, do we try to preserve this $500,000 of equity, or do we roll the dice and decide that if the market would turn around, that we've got a chance to make this back and indeed maybe make a handsome profit if this ever comes back. So we have a lot of producers that are looking at this right now. I have a little comment here about my drowning man. People in stress, the way I kind of think about people that are having financial stress is, if you can envision a man drowning, floundering in a pool of water, deep water, you know, if something floats by, that individual's going to grab onto that and he's going to hang on for dear life. And we have a lot of people that are really in that situation right now. They're drowning. They don't know where to go. They don't know what to do. And so, you know, we have to be careful as educators or people that are working with folks that are having problems, that we don't allow them to bring us down and drown with them. And it's a real caution. I just say that going in. Lessons that we learned from the 80s. One of the big lessons that I personally learned is that the role of the extension professional, or the role of person working with producers, is different when you're working with someone that's having financial stress than it is maybe in a typical extension situation. You know, we many times are looked at as the expert. Someone comes in and they have a weed that's been bothering their lawn, or they have a insect that's been a problem, and we're looked at as the expert, and we give the advice. We tell them exactly what to do. But I guess I would really caution you not to try to become an expert in this area. I believe that we're more of a facilitator or a coach, that it's our job to, you know, gather the information, to get as much as we can, to try to put that pen in their hands, helping them to make decisions, helping them to identify their issues, look at their alternatives, and then see if we can help them make their solutions, their decisions to make their solutions. It's you know, it's very good for the ego to be asked by someone, you know, what should I do? If you were me, what would you do? And I'll guarantee you that you'll be asked that question. But I think we're at a point in time where by giving them that answer, telling them what to do, what you've done is you've floated by this drowning man, and they're going to hang on to you and look to you for all the answers. That's probably not a good long-term way to deal with it for them. If you can help them to develop the skills and help them to develop the decision-making, evaluating alternatives, it's my opinion that you'll be much more effective if you can help them by guiding them and coaching them and mentoring them and facilitating them through this process rather than giving them all the answers. So what I've tried to do is to list a little bit of kind of a process that I try to go through when I'm working with a family. And, you know, it's very brief, but this might give you some ideas of how I work with families. I start off and an individual walks into my office, or I'm sitting down with them, and I try to consciously spend some time in an introduction. And what I'm trying to do with that introduction of who I am is convey to them that I have experience, that I've worked in this area for quite a while, that I'm not the person with all the answers, but they can trust me to help them work it through, that what I'm doing with them will be confidential. I'm not going to be talking about it at the with people they might know or with other colleagues. It's confidential. And I usually like to start out with asking them a question, something like, well, what brings you in, or how can I help you? And after I ask that question, then I want to just shut up and see what they have to say. many times that first thing that they have to say has very little to do with why they're actually in there. But what we're doing at this point is I'm starting to gather information, trying to figure out what in the world's going on, not just facts and figures, but also the feelings and some of those underlying things that are really going to help people make a decision. Not just listening with my ears, but also watching what's going on, looking at the nonverbal interaction. You know, there's many times it'll be a husband-wife or maybe a father-son. And if you watch that other person that's not doing the talking, you might gain as much information as you will from the person that's doing the talking. I think it's important to use all your senses and try to figure out what's going on here. I have a little item again about this pigeonholing. You know, again, it's if you've done a lot of it, and it looks like quite a few of you have been involved with this for a while, it's very easy for me to start saying, oh, this looks like a problem that I saw in the guy last week or the guy last year or something, and this is how we work through this, so this is what you need to do. You know, just a word of warning, don't, if you catch yourself doing that, try not to put people in that pigeonhole. You know, what we're doing is gathering information. One of the questions that helps me to gather information is just asking things like, what's your lender telling you? Did you bring a balance sheet with you? How have you valued your assets? Do you have an income and expense, any income expense records, any tax records? Have you done a cash flow? And you'll start to get information as to what's going on with that situation. You know, the expertise that I think we have as folks that are working with people in problems is not to tell them what to do, but to kind of work through this process and gather information, help them identify if there's something urgent. You know, maybe there's a deadline. Maybe there's a foreclosure coming up or a replevin action coming. You know, maybe there's a health issue or a housing issue, or maybe they're out of food, or maybe there's a mental health issue. It's help them identify what those urgent things are, and if there's something urgent, we have to deal with it. If there isn't anything urgent, then we can move on to identify what the key issue might be. Do we have a financial solvency problem? Are we short of collateral? Are we simply not cash flowing? Is the business not profitable? You know, we're going to use all those financial tools that are out there. We'll use some enterprise analysis, our cash flows, our balance sheets, trend sheets, so forth and so on. You know, maybe the issue is not financial at all. Maybe they've just lost credibility with their lender. But what we're trying to do is help this individual identify where the problem is, what the issue is. And then, you know, in Dick Hawkins' terms, those of you who maybe have been around a while, you know, Dick Hawkins always said, you help people identify where are you now, where do you want to be, and how are we going to get there? Well, once we identify where we are, then we have to look at where they're going to be. And when we look at the finish line, the where you want to be, to help people start getting a handle on this, we have to help them identify what's the first hurdle they have to get over to head toward that finish line. And I think that if we can do that, we can begin to get people a sense of, I am back in control of what's going on. So oftentimes people just don't know how to address it, where to go, and what to do. One of the other questions that I like to talk to folks about is basically prioritizing assets. Sometimes maybe one of the alternatives is to do some liquidation. Prioritizing those assets can help them think this through. Are the assets earning their keep? Are they actually paying the interest on what that loan might be against those assets? After we've done a bit of that, then I think we move to helping them think about what their options are. Where do they go? What are their alternatives? And again, if we can help them to identify the options rather than putting the pen in our hand, put the pen in theirs, have them write down what they think their alternatives are, eliminate things that they absolutely won't consider, and then gather the information that needs to be gathered. Some of it we might have to help them gather. Some of that information we maybe have better access to than they do. But the more that they can do, I think the happier they're going to be with the decisions that they make. When we finish gathering information, I always like to talk about, all right, what's next? What do we have to do? What's that first hurdle? Who's responsible to make sure it's done, and when does it have to be done by? Go through things one more time with them, make sure they're set to go. Give them my contact information and when it is and when it's not appropriate to contact you. I'll tell you, those people will call at 11, 12 o'clock at night if you don't tell them after a certain time, don't call. And you know, if it really is urgent and they need to call me, fine, but there's times when you have to be careful of that too. What else can we do today? And then one of the last things I like to do just before they're walking out the door is ask them, how are you dealing with all this stuff? Are you sleeping okay at night? And then I usually tell them, you know, normal people that are under stress like you are going through experience all kinds of symptoms, including problems sleeping or maybe sleeping all the time. Sometimes there's alcohol abuse or marriage issues, very difficult making decisions. If we have a situation in Nebraska where we have some free mental counseling available, and it's really good to know what resources are available for you in your own state. But I always tell them that if they would like help discussing how other people deal with these tough times, that they can follow up with this free mental counseling. And I think that's been very helpful to a lot of them. I believe right now in Nebraska we have, if I remember my numbers, I think there's 2,600 farm operators, farm people in Nebraska that are currently using this free mental counseling, way more than we ever expected. One other note, and I'll just make that about you personally. I really find that I need someone to be able to talk to myself, so that it's very difficult not to take these problems home with me. I have an individual that, an attorney that I work with, he and I work hand in hand in a lot of these situations. And I really think, be aware of that yourself, that it's important to have someone that you can diffuse with, someone that you can talk to, someone that you can confide in. You know, do it in a confidential way. You don't need to mention names, but it just gets to be a big load. And if you try to help folks work through some of these situations and aren't aware of it yourself, I think that you could end up paying a price that's pretty high yourself. With that, I'll just again put my contact information up. I'm more than happy to visit with any of you, and if you need someone to confide in and you don't have anyone, there's my office number, there's my cell number. Don't call after 6 o'clock at night. Other than that, that's pretty much concludes my remarks, John, and I'll pass it back to you.
Dave, thanks very much. One of the questions in from the audience is, what's the number one question you get when working with families?
I think I get asked almost every time, "What should I do? What would you do if what would you do if you were me?" You know, and I more or less always refuse to answer that directly. What I will come back is a question about, well, let's see if we can identify what your alternatives are. And, you know, if I choose the alternative that seems best to me, that's based on who I am and where my perspective is and what my background is. but I'm not going to go out there and manage this dairy for these people. I'm not going to go out there and live their life for them. So it's really important, I think, to help them make the decisions based on who they are, what's their situation, what their goals are. And I know they're going to be talking about goals. Probably Jeff's going to do that next week, but or next time. But, you know, we really need to think about where they're coming from and helping them to do that rather than me doing it for them.
And another member of our audience has asked, he says, you pointed to one example of a dairy producer losing $1,500. Mm-hmm. Per day. And is this a average dairy amount that represents most dairy producers? Of course, we'll probably ask this.
Probably not. This is about a 500 cow dairy. And just a little more about their situation. They had a lot of feed on hand, they were trying to decide what would it make most sense to run that feed through the existing dairy cows, or would they be better off doing something else with that feed? And so, you know, they were really facing a tough situation. Would that be typical? I would say, you know, I don't know. Maybe Jay can address that better than I could. What typical would be? We see a lot of dairies in Nebraska that are in that 200 to 2,000 cow range. Those would be probably most of ours. Are very small, of course, it's on a per cow basis. So,
one interaction that we had with one lender said that in their portfolio of dairies, the losses ran from $36 per cow per month to more than $150 per cow per month. Someone says, and this is the last question, and then we're going to move on to Jay, and we'll come back and have some other questions later. It says, in our state, we are finding there are not the extension or other like people to give the kind of assistance that you talk about providing. So where do producers go if they cannot afford to hire someone and the free help isn't there?
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that. Extension has changed throughout the United States. There was a time when our extension staff was dramatically larger than it is now as well. We're down to probably two or three people that would have any capability of being of any assistance right now. I don't know what state that would be. If they would individually want to get to me, I could possibly put them in touch with someone if I happen to know someone in that state, but there are not that many alternatives in some areas, and I certainly understand that's not a good situation.
It's one of the reasons we're having this, to see if we can galvanize some interest around and maybe think about some different ways and alternatives to supply some support for the families. My own experience is that there's often a lot of discussion about the industry and solutions for the industry, but the solutions for the family are often more difficult to come by.